Welcome to the Deep Dive, our intense look at the scientific landscape, custom tailored for you. This is really your shortcut to being well-informed on the cutting edge of research.
And we are absolutely ready to guide you through the latest findings. I'm Taylor Thorpe.
And I'm Alex Bell. Our mission today, well, it's to take this huge stack of sources covering everything from, you know, quantum physics to ancient viral biology and pull out the key insights, the complex mechanisms, and really the crucial so what behind the headlines.
Right. So if you want that deep, thorough understanding of the week's biggest discoveries, this is your deep dive.
Exactly. And this is Science for the Week of October 16th, 2025.
And we've got some truly monumental topics today. We're spanning millions of years, billions of atoms. We'll be looking at how hidden archives are informing climate policy and how we might engineer a more sustainable future.
Okay, let's jump right in. We'll start with a pretty dramatic environmental focus. These ancient threats and, well, hidden scientific archives locked in the ice, particularly in the polar regions, which are thawing so rapidly now.
Mm-hmm. We begin up in Svalbard, that remote Norwegian archipelago. There's a researcher there, Sebastian Kalvinjak Spencer, who's on this really fascinating and frankly critical mission.
Yeah, his mission is basically to look for a hidden history of RNA viruses, things like influenza, polio, maybe even Ebola, that might be locked away in the Arctic permafrost. The whole idea is that this permafrost could be acting as a kind of virus vault.
A virus vault. Wow, that sounds intense. But why Svalbard specifically? And what makes permafrost such a good preserver?
Well, permafrost is pretty ideal because it offers consistently cold and dry conditions over very long timescales. You see, over generations, wildlife, migrating birds, mammals, other animals, they've shed viruses. And it's possible those viral genomes are still just lingering in that frozen soil preserved by these exceptional conditions.
Now, we hear a lot about ancient DNA surviving for ages, but Kalvinjak Spencer is specifically hunting for RNA viruses.
Mm.
And that brings up a huge challenge, right? Fragility. It absolutely does. And this is really where the research starts to push back against some long-standing scientific dogma. You see, RNA, unlike DNA, it's single-stranded. It doesn't have that stabilizing double helix structure.
Uh-huh.
And chemically, the sugar in its backbone, it's got an extra oxygen atom, which makes it more prone to breaking down. But honestly, the biggest enemy of RNA, it's just everywhere. These things called ribonucleases, or RNases.
And RNases are enzymes that specifically target and destroy RNA.
That's right. Organisms use them to, you know, break down their own RNA or defend against RNA viruses. And these enzymes are notoriously stable, very efficient. So the prevailing wisdom for a very long time has been that RNA just degrades almost instantly in geological terms, making ancient RNA retrieval seem, well, basically impossible.
So what gives Kalvinjak Spencer the confidence that this seemingly impossible mission might actually work? Why look for it?
Well, he argues, quite compellingly, I think, that this idea of RNA fragility is maybe an overstated dogma, something that's discouraged others from even trying. And he has some pretty strong previous successes to back this up.
Okay.
He's actually recovered old RNA virus genomes from samples preserved in formalin. Things like a measles virus from a child's lung tissue preserved way back in 1912, and even genomes of the 1918 Spanish flu.
Right. Formalin, that's common in museum preservation. How does that relate to permafrost conditions?
Well, formalin seems to act similarly to intense cold in one really critical way. It deactivates those RNases.
Oh. Okay.
And the moment you neutralize those hostile enzymes, suddenly the inherent chemical instability of RNA itself becomes, well, maybe manageable. It gives the RNA molecule a fighting chance to survive for decades, maybe even millennia, if the conditions are right.
Okay, so here's where it connects to us today. Why does finding this ancient RNA actually matter for modern diseases, for understanding viral evolution?
It matters because it could help us break through what scientists call the phylogenetic horizon.
Phylogenetic horizon.
Yeah, so when researchers compare modern virus genomes to trace their history back, the really rapid mutation rate of RNA viruses, think flu or SARS, it means that our genetic comparison methods, these phylogenetic trees, they only go back so far.
Okay.
For a lot of common viruses, like respiratory syncytial virus, the last common ancestor we can detect using just modern genomes might only date back to the 20th century. Ancient RNA, if we can find it, completely bypasses this limit. It gives us actual physical reference points deep in the past.
Meaning we could potentially trace the lineage of common cold coronaviruses like OC43 or 229E, maybe back to when they first jumped into humans. or get a much clearer picture of how influenza was evolving before the huge 1918 pandemic.
Exactly that. It could fundamentally change how we understand disease ecology, these spillover events from animals to humans. And look, this isn't just theoretical. We have strong precedents. Remember that 1998 expedition? They went to Longyearbyen Cemetery in Svalbard to exhume Spanish flu victims.
I do, yeah. That didn't go so well, did it?
No, it largely failed because the bodies weren't perfectly frozen. There was frost heave, temperature fluctuations. The preservation wasn't ideal, and that failure really discouraged a lot of people for a long time.
But Kelvin Yak Spencer had a counterexample showing success is possible if the conditions are perfect. The penguins, right?
Yes, the mummified penguins.
Yeah.
He got tissue samples from these 1,900-year-old Adélie penguins found in Antarctica. And despite, you know, deep skepticism that always surrounds any ancient RNA claim, his lab managed to piece together the genomes of several viruses from these mummies, including a near-complete rotavirus genome.
Oh.
It proves that where the cold and dry conditions are truly exceptional and consistent, RNA can actually survive for vast stretches of time.
That's incredible. And it leads us nicely into another piece of climate research that also takes this long view, looking back millions of years, using geological archives to kind of contextualize our current climate crisis.
Yes, this is a really crucial study looking at global mean sea level, or GMSL, over the last 4.5 million years. Understanding ancient sea levels is fundamentally tied to understanding climate sensitivity, basically. How sensitive are the big ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, to sustain periods of warmth?
And this research provided a new reconstruction. What was different about their approach? What made their data more refined?
The key innovation here was how they handled the complexity in analyzing oxygen isotopes found in deep sea sediment cores. Older models often treated these isotopes as a fairly straightforward proxy just for ice volume.
Okay.
But this new work, it carefully separated out three major effects that influenced those isotopes.
That sure were.
Well, first, they accounted for temperature-driven changes in the isotopic composition within the ice sheets themselves. Second, they separated that from the effect of changes in the total volume of ice. And third, they accounted for changes in the overall ocean temperature. By isolating these different components, they could get a much cleaner, more refined picture of how ice sheets have behaved over really long geological timescales.
So this isn't just an academic history lesson. This deep look back gives us crucial context on how variable ice sheets have been, giving climate scientists a firmer baseline for projecting, you know, how sensitive Greenland and Antarctica might be to the warming we're causing right now. That's directly relevant to coastal planning today.
Precisely.
Yeah.
We're dealing with the stability of a system that can change dramatically. And sticking with fragile systems, let's shift from the deep past to a modern ecological crisis. Marine biodiversity loss in the Philippines. This is one of the most biodiverse places on Earth, but also one under intense pressure.
Right. And this particular research was only possible because of a very lucky decision made by scientists over a century ago. They compared modern fish samples with specimens collected by the USS Albatross way back between 1907 and 1910.
And the scientific break here was huge. The Albatross crew, they didn't use formalin, which was the standard preservative back then. Formalin is notorious for messing up DNA, cross-linking it. Instead, for some reason, they preserved their fish specimens in high-proof rum.
Wait, rum? Rum saved the day for genetic analysis a century later.
It looks that way. The high-proof alcohol apparently left the genetic material remarkably intact, much better than formalin would have. It allowed the modern research team to get high-quality ancient DNA sequences from these century-old fish.
That's amazing. So when they compared the genetics of these historic rum-preserved fish to their modern descendants, what did they find out about the impact of the last 100 years? Heavy fishing, pollution?
Well, for three specific species, they looked at two types of ponyfish and one cardinal fish. They found that genetic diversity dropped by a really significant 4% to 6% over that century.
And how does that compare? Is that a lot?
It's quite startling, actually. When you compare it to similar studies in temperate marine species, the average diversity loss observed there is only about 2%. So this suggests the pressures in the Philippines, the combination of heavy fishing, habitat degradation, pollution, it's creating a faster, more acute crisis for genetic diversity.
And losing genetic diversity, that's essentially losing the raw material for evolution, isn't it? Less adaptability.
It absolutely is. Think of it like burning the library of potential solutions before you even know what future challenges you'll face. As researchers pointed out, less genetic diversity means those fish populations just have less inherent ability to adapt to ongoing ocean changes, rising temperatures, acidification, changes in food sources. The ponyfish data was particularly worrying. It showed signs of a severe population bottleneck in the last 50 years or so, suggesting the breeding population might have crashed down to just dozens of individuals in some areas.
That sounds incredibly precarious. Was there any glimmer of hope in the data? Any sign that adaptation can happen, even under such intense pressure?
There was, actually, and it was really crucial finding related to the black-belted cardinal fish. While the species overall definitely lost diversity, about 4% of its genetic markers showed strong evidence of recent selection, of adaptation.
Selection for what, specifically? Surviving pollution, warmer water.
Selection for traits that allowed them to better survive these extreme environmental changes.
Yeah.
And what's really fascinating is that this evolutionary signal, this adaptation, was strongest in the Cebu Strait, which is the area that suffered the most intense environmental impacts from human activity.
Uh-huh.
It demonstrates that evolution, when it's forced by really intense pressure, can happen surprisingly quickly. But, and this is a big but, it's absolutely not a guarantee that it will happen fast enough or effectively enough to save a species from catastrophic decline.
That's a really powerful point. Okay, so we've gone from the huge scale of global sea levels and ancient viruses down to the genetic code of individual fish. Now let's pivot a bit, moving away from large-scale ecology to look at the fascinating mechanics of complex systems starting small with ant behavior and then moving up to global engineering challenges.
Right, let's shift gears to systems engineering, both in nature and in industry. And black garden ants, believe it or not, provide this absolutely stunning example of an evolved behavioral system that researchers are now calling architectural immunity.
Architectural immunity. Okay, we know that living in dense groups, being highly social, increases disease risk, right? Whether you're in a human city or an ant colony. So how do these ants deal with that?
Well, the researchers exposed colonies of these black garden ants to a fungal pathogen. And the ants didn't just change their individual behaviors, like, you know, grooming more or isolating sick individuals. They actually changed the physical structure of their home. Specifically, they started building their nests with significantly greater distances between the entrances.
So they literally redesigned their nests for better quarantine. How effective could a simple change like that actually be for the whole colony?
Surprisingly effective, it turns out. When they modeled it, these architectural changes drastically altered how individuals moved within the nest, how they interacted. And just by increasing the distance between entrances, they significantly reduced the overall transmission of the disease throughout the entire colony. It's a really clear demonstration of this architectural immunity concept, this evolved strategy, where physical planning itself becomes a defense mechanism against disease in a crowded social setting.
That is brilliant. Almost intuitive when you think about it. Okay, so if ants can change their architecture to fight disease, what happens when we look at the ultimate natural navigation system, an animal brain operating out in the wild over huge distances?
Yes, this is a massive leap forward in neuroscience. It addresses a really critical gap in our understanding. For decades, scientists have studied the brain's internal compass, this ring attractor network, made of head direction cells, but almost always in tiny controlled lab environments, like a rat in a 2-meter box. The big question was always, do the principles we see in the lab actually hold up across a vast, complex natural landscape?
And now, thanks to new miniature wireless loggers, they finally got an answer. They tracked Egyptian fruit bats navigating this huge remote oceanic island, an area covering something like 87,500 square meters. Massive.
And the key finding was a resounding yes. Those head direction cells, the neurons that fire only when the animal is facing a specific direction, say north, regardless of where it is on the island, they maintained incredibly stable, globally consistent tuning. The same cell fired for north, whether the bat was flying over the southern beach or deep in the island's interior.
That level of stability across such a huge, visually complex area is just incredible. I mean, the view must change completely from one spot to another. Did the stability happen instantly, or did the bats need to learn the island?
That's a great question. No, it wasn't instant. That's an important detail. The cells only became stable and reliably anchored to this global reference frame after about 3 to 6 nights of the bats actually exploring and experiencing the island.
Ah, okay.
That learning period seems essential because the brain has to constantly correct for the noise that accumulates from its own movement cues, turning, flying, etc. It needs to anchor itself to reliable external cues to keep that internal compass accurate.
So here's the big puzzle the researchers then faced. In a small lab box, maybe one big visual cue on the wall is enough to anchor the compass. But on a huge island, if you're facing north, the scenery you see is completely different at the north end versus the south end. So how does the brain maintain that single consistent sense of north when the visual input is changing so drastically?
Right. They quickly ruled out using celestial cues, like the moon or stars. Their positions change too much, clouds get in the way, they're just not stable enough anchors over time. So the system must be relying on terrestrial landmarks, things on the ground.
Okay.
And this led them to propose two main computational models, two possible strategies the brain might be using to handle this massive mapping challenge.
Okay, walk us through those two models. What are the options?
So the first idea is what they call continuous scene anchoring. This model suggests that the brain's ring attractor network has to continuously, locally, associate its firing pattern, its sense of direction, with whatever visual scene is visible at every single location across the entire island. It's constantly updating based on the changing background.
That sounds computationally really intense. A lot of processing power needed.
It does. It would require really complex, continuous learning to keep updating that association and avoid navigational drift. It seems like it would have a high computational overhead for the brain.
So what's the alternative? Maybe a more efficient approach?
The second model, which might be a bit more resource-friendly for the brain, is called mosaic landmark anchoring. This idea posits that the bat doesn't try to map everything continuously. Instead, it mentally breaks the island down, splits its cognitive map into different spatial fragments or zones.
Like tiling the map?
Exactly. And within each zone, the head direction network selects just a small handful of specific, highly reliable local landmarks, maybe a particular tall tree, a unique rock formation, and it uses those landmarks to anchor the compass only when the bat is within that specific segment of the map.
Ah, so the overall sense of north stays the same globally, but the specific physical cues the brain uses to lock onto that direction change depending on which part of the mosaic the bat is currently in. It's like breaking the big problem down into smaller, manageable pieces.
Precisely. It splits the cognitive load. This research isn't just fascinating biology. It provides vital clues for designing the next generation of navigation systems for things like self-driving cars or autonomous drones that need to operate reliably in large, complex, real-world environments.
That's a perfect transition, actually, into our next big system challenge, one requiring massive innovation and maybe even new computational models, decarbonizing the global aviation industry.
Yeah, aviation is widely seen as one of the toughest sectors to abate emissions from. Right now, it's about 3% of global emissions. But that number is projected to rise significantly as more people fly globally. The core issue, as the sources really lay out, is that current investment priorities are heavily skewed towards low-risk, mature, kind of incremental technologies, and that completely ignores the need for radical transformative innovations if we're actually serious about hitting net zero by 2050.
Right. The fundamental conflict is between traffic growth, which airlines need for profit, and CO2 emissions, which drive climate change. The goal has to be to somehow decouple those two things, make flying grow without emissions growing.
And if you look at the official roadmaps from major international bodies, they all show this pretty chilling graph.
Mm-hmm.
Aviation emissions keep rising until somewhere in the mid-2030s, and then somehow they have to plummet incredibly steeply to meet those net zero targets.
But the current plans aren't going to achieve that cliff dive.
Not even close. Most current airline and manufacturer investment plans are just utterly insufficient to enable that kind of drastic required drop in emissions.
So the problem is that investors and R&D managers are stuck in this familiarity bias. They're overweighting what they already know works, even if it won't scale.
That seems to be a big part of it. It means they focus heavily on things like conventional sustainable aviation fuels, or SAFs. Often these are made from readily available feedstocks, like used cooking oil or animal fats.
Which sound good, but...
But while these SAFs are definitely cleaner burning than traditional kerosene, the global supply of those specific feedstocks is just fundamentally limited. We still cannot scale them up enough to fuel the entire global fleet. We'd run out of waste oil long before we get anywhere near net zero.
So the truly radical ideas get left behind.
Exactly. Things like aircraft powered entirely by hydrogen, or radical new aerodynamic designs like blended wing bodies, or even sophisticated systems for dynamically avoiding creating contrails. These are largely neglected because they represent much bigger technological hurdles and therefore bigger financial risks for investors.
Okay, so if the standard financial metrics are actually steering capital away from the necessary disruptive technologies, what's the proposed fix? How do we get green capital flowing towards these high-risk, high-reward ideas?
The Policy Forum article proposes implementing something called the Aviation Sustainability Index, or ASI. Think of it like a credit rating, but specifically for climate impact potential.
Yeah.
It's designed as a scoring mechanism that measures how much an investment actually contributes to decoupling traffic growth from emissions.
Okay, explain that decoupling measurement. What's this deviation from the baseline diagonal they talk about?
Okay, picture a graph. Horizontal axis is traffic growth, vertical axis is CO2 emissions. Now, if an investment just involves, say, swapping kerosene for a drop-in biofuel in a standard plane, your emissions might drop a bit, but they still basically track traffic growth proportionally. That follows the baseline diagonal line on the graph.
Got it.
To achieve true decoupling, an investment needs to push the emissions curve significantly below that diagonal. The ASI score basically quantifies how effectively an investment does that, how much it lowers emissions relative to the traffic growth it enables.
So a technology like a pure hydrogen aircraft, even though it's super high risk initially, would get a massive ASI score because its potential for decoupling emissions from growth is enormous, right? Zero emissions in flight.
Exactly. Yeah. And the key is how this score translates into a real financial incentive.
Yeah.
By making these ASI scores transparent, standardized internationally, they could be used to unlock specific pools of capital designated as green. Crucially, investments that earn high ASI scores, the truly transformative ones, would become eligible for lower borrowing costs. The sources suggest this could be as much as a full percentage point reduction on loans.
Wow, a full percent is huge in aviation finance.
It's massive, especially in the incredibly capital-intensive world of designing and building new aircraft. It creates a powerful financial pull towards genuine climate solutions and helps combat greenwashing by forcing transparency and accountability based on the actual potential climate impact of an investment.
That's a fascinating mechanism, and it leads us perfectly into our next section, where we look inward at the infrastructure and policies shaping science itself, what we might call the architecture of science.
Right, and we start with a really immediate threat to research integrity that's actually born out of, well, an abundance of data. It's about the rise of open health data and its misuse.
This is the issue where big publishers like PLOS and Frontiers are now banning or putting severe restrictions on papers that are based only on analyzing publicly available health data sets. Things like the big U.S. National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, NANES.
Yes. And the reason for these drastic measures is the quite disturbing proliferation of what are often called paper mills. These are essentially operations, some possibly using AI now, that are exploiting these incredibly rich public data sets.
How are they exploiting them?
Well, NANES, for example, it contains just a massive number of variables on health, diet, environment, demographics, everything. With so many variables, it becomes statistically easy to just mine the data until you find some correlation between two things that look significant but is actually just pure chance, random noise.
So finding spurious correlations that aren't biologically real?
Precisely. They churn out these questionable papers reporting these chance findings, and then they apparently sell authorship slots on these papers to researchers who need publications quickly, perhaps unethically. The sheer volume of these junk papers started to overwhelm journals and really threaten the credibility of research using these public data sets.
The numbers you mentioned are pretty staggering. PLO saw its rejection rate for these kinds of papers jump from 40% to 94%, and Frontiers rejected over 5,000 papers.
Yeah, the scale of the problem became undeniable. So the new policy from these publishers essentially requires authors to provide external validation.
Meaning
they can't just show the correlation from the public database. They now have to provide some independent evidence, maybe data from their own private patient cohort, or results from an actual lab experiment, something that confirms the finding is likely real and biologically plausible, not just a statistical fluke.
Okay, these guardrails seem necessary to restore trust, but there are concerns about the side effects, right? The collateral damage.
Absolutely. There's a real worry that these strict restrictions could create significant barriers for genuine ethical researchers, especially those in the global south or at smaller institutions. These researchers often rely heavily, sometimes exclusively, on free, public, taxpayer-funded resources like NACINE because they just don't have the funding for large private data sets or extensive lab experiments.
So it raises equity concerns.
It does. There's a fear that scientific integrity is being shored up, but potentially at the cost of accessibility and equity in science. And furthermore, some critics worry that the paper mills will just adapt their tactics, maybe start finding spurious links across two public databases instead of one, forcing publishers into this constant cat and mouse game.
A tricky balance. And speaking of chaos impacting scientific infrastructure, we have to touch on the massive instability caused by political battles, specifically the recurring threat of U.S. government shutdowns.
Yeah, the situation described in the sources sounds incredibly disruptive. One scientist literally compared the recent chaos, mass layoffs, furloughs, then sudden reversals to getting hit by a car right after you've barely survived a train wreck. It's just piling instability on top of previous turmoil like hiring freezes and grant cuts. The uncertainty has become systemic.
And the impact on the actual scientific work is immediate and pretty brutal.
It really is. You have essential federal staff forced to work without pay people, managing complex space missions, running vital clinical trials, even caring for sensitive lab animal colonies where work just cannot stop without immediate disaster. Meanwhile, most of the staff who process grants are furloughed, which just brings the entire grant review and funding pipeline to a grinding halt.
The ripple effects for the scientific workforce and even global collaboration must be huge.
Enormous. Think about that anecdote mentioned, the bioinorganic chemist who's worried that even a short grant delay could force her to shut down her lab entirely after 30 years, just because the funding gap becomes unsustainable. This kind of financial insecurity, coupled with the instability of potential layoffs or furloughs, it really encourages early and mid-career federal scientists, the future leaders, to leave for more stable jobs elsewhere.
And it impacts international projects, too.
Definitely. The example given was the National Science Foundation staff being furloughed right when they needed to be coordinating substitute icebreakers for upcoming Antarctic research. If that coordination fails because people aren't working, the entire Southern Hemisphere research season could be jeopardized, hindering crucial climate data collection and damaging international scientific partnerships.
Wow. That internal U.S. instability really stands in stark contrast to the kind of long-term, ambitious science funding plans coming out of Europe that you also looked at.
Yes, it's quite a difference. The EU is planning the next iteration of its main research and innovation funding program, Horizon Europe, for the period 2028 to 2034. And the headline news is a proposed massive budget increase up to $175 billion, which is an 83% jump from the previous $95 billion program.
That's a huge commitment to science and innovation. How is that funding structured?
It's built around four main pillars, including things like excellent science and competitiveness in society. That excellent science pillar is particularly important because it houses the funding for the European Research Council, the ERC. And the ERC is really renowned for championing fundamental, curiosity-driven, blue-sky research based purely on scientific merit.
But there's some concern about the balance, particularly with the focus on the competitiveness pillar.
There is, yes. The worry stems from a requirement for Horizon Europe to coordinate closely with a new European Competitiveness Fund, which is inherently focused on shorter-term industrial and economic development goals. The fear within the research community is that this could risk diverting Horizon funds away from long-term fundamental research and towards more immediate policy-driven objectives like solving today's industrial problems.
And the argument is that undermining fundamental research ultimately hurts competitiveness in the long run.
Exactly. The breakthroughs that drive future competitiveness often come from that fundamental, curiosity-driven science years or decades earlier. So the research community is advocating strongly for research to be seen as a core component of competitiveness itself, not just a tool to serve short-term policy goals.
Makes sense. But on a brighter note, Horizon Europe seems to be succeeding as a platform for global scientific collaboration.
It really is. That international dimension is quite strong. Switzerland and South Korea became fully associated countries in 2025, meaning their researchers can fully participate and get funding. Egypt is expected to join soon. And major research nations like Japan, aiming for 2026, and Australia are actively exploring association agreements too.
That's encouraging. It strengthens global science capacity.
It does. And it promotes scientific cooperation and potentially protects academic freedom through these shared international frameworks.
Okay, let's tie together some of these threads, policy, innovation, economics, by looking at the ideas that won this year's Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences.
Right, the prize honored two really key concepts for understanding how economies achieve sustained growth, especially in our modern technological era. First, Joel Mokyr was recognized for his insight that just having an invention isn't enough for growth. You need to understand the deep science that underlies the innovation to really diffuse it, improve it, and get sustained economic benefit from it. Foundational knowledge is key.
Okay, and the other half of the prize
went to Philip Aguillon and Peter Howitt for their work championing the concept of creative destruction. This is the dynamic idea, originally from Schumpeter, that sustained economic growth requires established industries and technologies to be constantly challenged, displaced, and essentially destroyed by innovative newcomers. Stagnation is the enemy of growth.
And Agian has applied this idea of creative destruction to really current major challenges we're facing, like AI.
Exactly. He points out that AI clearly involves significant job destruction. That's the destruction part. But it also promises huge productivity gains, the creative part.
So what's the policy implication for managing the AI revolution, according to this framework?
Well, Agian argues you can't and shouldn't try to stop the innovation itself. Instead, the focus should be on managing the transition. That means implementing generous unemployment support and really robust, continuous retraining programs to help those whose jobs are displaced by AI. The goal is to cushion the negative social impacts while still capturing the economic benefits of the productivity gains.
And how does creative destruction offer a lens, maybe even some hope, for tackling the climate crisis?
It suggests an inherent dynamic that can help overcome resistance to change. You see, established companies, the incumbents, often resist green policies because they're heavily invested in and profiting from existing dirty technologies.
Right.
But new firms, the startups, they aren't tied down by that legacy infrastructure or those old business models. So creative destruction naturally pushes for green innovation because it allows these new players, the innovators in solar and batteries and green hydrogen, to challenge and eventually displace the established polluting incumbents. It can drive the necessary green transition potentially even faster than policy alone might achieve by leveraging these market forces.
That's a really profound way to think about leveraging economic dynamics for a huge planetary challenge. Okay, let's shift gears completely now. We'll move from economics and policy to the really cutting-edge materials and energy innovations that might power our future into engineering tomorrow.
Yes, and let's start with green hydrogen production. It's seen as a critical piece of the decarbonized energy puzzle. Specifically, we're looking at a technology called anion exchange membrane electrolyzers, or AEMs.
Right. AEMs are exciting because they tackle the cost issue of hydrogen production head on, don't they? They let manufacturers use cheap, abundant catalysts like nickel and iron, avoiding the need for expensive precious metals like platinum or iridium used in other systems. Plus, they can run on pure water, which simplifies things.
Exactly. But this really promising technology has always been kind of hobbled by one major persistent problem: durability. The core component, the ionomer, that's the polymer electrolyte that conducts the ions, tends to degrade pretty quickly in the high pH alkaline environment that AEMs need to operate in, especially when it's exposed to the high electrical potentials at the electrode surface during operation. This chemical breakdown just limits their lifespan too much for widespread commercial use.
So the challenge was to protect that vulnerable polymer electrolyte physically and chemically, but without blocking its ability to conduct ions. How did they solve that using materials engineering?
Well, they took inspiration from work done on creating stable interfaces in lithium-ion batteries. The researchers introduced this very stable organic-inorganic layer right at the interface between the ionomer and the anode catalyst. They used a common material, zirconium peroxide. This material forms a kind of chemical scaffolding, creating cross-linked networks between the ionomer-polymer chains and the catalyst particles.
That sounds incredibly intricate at the nanoscale. What does that specific architecture actually achieve? How does it help?
This new cross-link structure acts like a dense protective shield. Chemically, it blocks the migration of those highly reactive oxidative species that are generated during electrolysis and that normally attack and break down the ionomer backbone. But at the same time, because of the way it's structured, these cross-link networks actually help reinforce the pathways for ion conduction, so protection and performance.
And the result? How much better did it make the AEMs?
The result was dramatic and repeatable. They measured a more than 20-fold reduction in the rate of ionomer degradation compared to standard AEM systems without this protective interface.
Wow, a 20-fold improvement. That's potentially transformative. It could really unlock AEMs for scalable, commercial, green hydrogen production, driving down fuel costs. And you mentioned another environmental benefit, too.
Yes, potentially. This offers a viable path away from relying on perfluoroethyl-based materials, like the well-known Nafion, which have dominated electrochemical devices for years, but raise environmental concerns due to their persistence. They're part of that PFAS family of fluorochemicals. Finding effective alternatives is a big deal.
Okay, moving from durable fuel production to another area of ingenious material design, we absolutely have to talk about the winners of this year's Chemistry Nobel Prize. They pioneered a whole new class of materials based on molecular architecture. metal organic frameworks.
That's right. Susumu Kitagawa, Richard Robson, and Omar Yagi shared the prize for their foundational work on metal organic frameworks, or MOFs. These are completely synthetic, crystalline materials that are incredibly porous, like microscopic sponges. They're built using organic molecules, acting like rigid struts, to link together metal atoms or clusters into vast, ordered three-dimensional networks with huge internal spaces.
Robson had the initial concept back in the 80s, linking metal senders with organic bits, but stability was an issue then?
Correct. His early structures often weren't very robust. It was Kitagawa in the 1990s who really demonstrated that you could make stable, porous frameworks this way, kind of challenging the conventional wisdom in material science at the time. But the field truly exploded in 1999 when Omar Yagi synthesized the now iconic material called MOF-5.
And Yagi's MOF-5 really illustrates the mind-boggling scale of the porosity we're talking about here.
It absolutely does. Just 1 gram, like a sugar cube's worth of MOF-5, has an internal surface area equivalent to an entire football field. It's astonishing. But their real power comes from their tunability. By carefully choosing different organic linker molecules and different metal nodes, chemists can precisely tailor the size, the shape, and the chemical properties of the internal pores to selectively trap specific target molecules.
If you can draw it, you can make it, as Yagi sometimes says. So what are the big applications being targeted now? Where could MOFs make a difference?
Oh, the potential applications are enormous because of that molecular selectivity. They can be designed for highly efficient separation and storage of gases, think storing hydrogen safely at high density for fuel cells, or separating methane from other gases. They're being developed to pull pure drinking water directly out of humid air, even in deserts. There's huge potential for carbon capture from power plants or industrial sources. They could also be used to sequester toxic waste or even act as sensors to detect tiny traces of explosives in the air.
That's already a huge list, but Kitagawa has an even grander vision for what MOFs might eventually achieve, doesn't he?
He really does. His ultimate dream isn't just to use MOFs to separate the basic components of air, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen. He envisions using MOFs as tiny, efficient catalytic reactors that could actually convert those atmospheric components directly into useful products, like proteins for food or new types of fuels. He calls the air around us invisible gold.
Invisible gold.
Arguing that we're literally surrounded by all the chemical building blocks needed for life and industry if only we had the right tools, like MOFs, to harvest and assemble them correctly. It's a breathtaking vision.
Truly is. Okay, let's dive even deeper now, shifting from molecular architecture to the quantum frontier, looking at a breakthrough involving exotic particles in two-dimensional materials.
Right, this is a highly technical advance, but it's about stabilizing and studying particles called trions. Now, trions are what physicists call quasi-particles. They're formed when you have three fundamental particles, three fermions, interacting strongly. Specifically, it's usually an exciton, which is itself a bound pair of an electron and an electron hole, plus one extra charge carrier, either another electron or another hole.
And normally, because these things involve electrons and holes that really want to recombine and annihilate each other, trions are incredibly short-lived, right? Like picoseconds.
Exactly. They flicker in and out of existence almost instantly. That makes them very hard to study. But the breakthrough here, achieved independently by two different research teams, was demonstrating that you can create long-lived trions that exist in a state of thermal equilibrium. They did this using carefully engineered double layers of 2D materials, specifically transition metal dichalcogenides.
Okay, achieving thermal equilibrium, meaning the trions are being created and destroyed at the same rate, leading to a stable population. Why is that so difficult usually? And how did they manage to stabilize these normally fleeting particles?
It's difficult because of that inherent drive for recombination.
Mm.
They stabilize them by first bringing the two 2D material layers incredibly close together, creating strong coupling between them. And second, by very precisely controlling the density of charge carriers, electrons, and holes independently in each layer. By carefully tuning this energy landscape, they managed to suppress the rapid recombination processes. This allowed a stable fluid of these interlayer trions to form and persist long enough to be studied properly.
And what does getting these trions into a stable equilibrium state actually open up for quantum science? What's the big so what here?
Well, it sets the stage for potentially observing and studying entirely new exotic states of quantum matter. Because trions are formed from three particles, they have a relatively heavy effective mass compared to electrons or excitons. Now, if you could take this stable trion fluid, cool it down and maybe compress it.
What happens?
The prediction is that these heavy trions might spontaneously arrange themselves into a highly ordered periodic lattice structure, purely due to their mutual repulsion and heavy mass.
Yeah.
This is a state called a Wigner crystal.
A Wigner crystal? That's kind of a holy grail in condensed matter physics, isn't it? A crystal made just of interacting particles without an underlying atomic lattice?
It absolutely is. It's a fundamental state of matter driven purely by quantum interactions. Furthermore, having this stable trion fluid allows scientists to study complex mixtures, Bose-Fermi mixtures, where trions, excitons, and free electrons or holes all coexist and interact. These complex quantum soups could potentially lead to completely new, unconventional mechanisms for superconductivity, perhaps enabling new forms of low-energy electronics in the future. Realizing this equilibrium trion fluid is a really significant step forward.
From the deep quantum realm, let's pivot now to perhaps the most personal science breakthroughs impacting human health and our fundamental understanding of biology. It's time for decoding the body.
And we should start with a really important and frankly overdue focus on women's health. This is a field that, as the sources highlight, has suffered from systemic neglect for decades, largely because medicine historically used the male body, male physiology, as the default standard for research.
Right. And this bias hasn't just affected reproductive health. It's created huge knowledge gaps in how we understand and treat diseases that affect the sexes differently. Things like cardiovascular disease, where women often have completely different heart attack symptoms than men, or Alzheimer's disease, which hits women almost twice as often as men.
The sources use preeclampsia as a perfect and tragic example of this neglect. It's a really dangerous pregnancy complication. Kills around 70,000 women and 500,000 infants globally every single year. Yet, despite this devastating impact, it's received shockingly little research and development investment over the years.
Why? Why would such a severe, costly condition be so persistently overlooked by major drug developers?
Well, the article points to two main factors. First, it's often been historically dismissed as just a transient crisis, something that resolves once the baby is delivered. That view fails to attract the kind of long-term R&D funding that chronic diseases get. But second, and perhaps more critically, there's been this powerful chilling effect related to fetal safety.
Meaning the risk of harming the fetus.
Exactly. The placenta is a complex barrier. Developing a drug that works on the mother but absolutely must not cross the placenta and potentially harm the developing fetus is incredibly challenging. That perceived risk, that complexity, has historically deterred pharmaceutical companies for generations.
But Beach Biotech, a startup mentioned in the sources, seems to have found a clever way around this fetal safety barrier using bioengineering.
They have.
Yeah.
Their approach focuses on treating the underlying cause in the mother without letting the treatment reach the fetus. In preeclampsia, the placenta goes haywire and releases way too much of a protein called FT1. This excess FT1 acts like a sponge, soaking up growth factors like VEGF and PLGF that the mother desperately needs to maintain healthy blood vessels. This leads to her high blood pressure and organ damage.
Okay.
So Beach Biotech designed a therapeutic antibody. This antibody specifically binds to that excess LT1 protein and helps clear it from the mother's system, essentially removing the harmful sponge.
But the real innovation is in the antibody's design itself, right? How it avoids the fetus.
Precisely. The antibody molecule has been cleverly modified so that it physically cannot cross the placental barrier. This ingenious design confines the therapeutic effect entirely to the mother's circulation, directly addressing and overcoming that primary fetal safety concern that has blocked progress on preeclampsia drugs for so long.
That's fantastic.
And it really reflects a broader positive shift happening globally. A growing recognition, finally, that sex is a fundamental biological variable. That research must account for sex differences, driven both by scientific proof like seeing breast cancer survival rates jump when treatments account for hormonal differences, and by having more women reach leadership roles in science and medicine.
Okay, moving from the scale of the whole body down to the level of individual cells, we've got new insights into how our earliest blood cells decide what they're going to become, a process where historically we've relied mostly on measuring RNA.
Yes, and the fundamental challenge here is something we see across biology. Single-cell RNA sequencing, or transcriptomics, has been revolutionary for mapping cells. But the amount of RNA, the genetic message, often doesn't correlate very well with the amount of the actual functional unit in the cell, the protein.
So measuring the recipe doesn't always tell you how much of the final dish is actually made or being used?
Exactly. Just looking at RNA transcripts risks missing crucial information about what the cell is actually doing at the protein level, where regulation really happens.
So to get a clear picture, researchers needed to combine the RNA view with a protein view.
That's what they did. They developed and applied single-cell proteomics using mass spectrometry, ADCP-MS, and integrated that protein data with traditional single-cell RNA sequencing data. They did this for over 2,500 hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells, or HSPCs. These are the master cells that give rise to our entire blood system.
And what did combining these two views, RNA and protein, reveal about how these stem cells differentiate?
The integrated data set, combining both RNA and protein information, was significantly better at predicting what type of blood cell a stem cell would eventually become, say, a red blood cell, versus a specific type of white blood cell than either data set could predict on its own. They complement each other.
Okay.
But here's the crucial finding. They discovered that the correlation between protein levels and mRNA levels was particularly poor in the very earliest, most immature stem cell populations.
And those are the cells making the critical decisions about their future.
Precisely. Those are the cells where fate decisions are actively being made. So transcriptomics alone, just looking at RNA, was actually missing vital information during those critical early stages of differentiation. Measuring the proteins directly gave a much clearer picture of those key decisions.
And they even developed a tool to model this dynamically.
They did. They created a computational method called single-cell protein velocity, or cPortfolio. It uses the known kinetics of translation, how fast mRNA messages get turned into proteins, to help resolve the flow of information over time within the cell. It really highlights why integrating multiple omics layers, like proteomics, is essential for truly understanding complex biological systems.
Okay, our final deep dive into the body takes us right to the synapse, resolving one of the oldest debates in neuroscience. Exactly how do synaptic vesicles release their neurotransmitter cargo and then get recycled so quickly and efficiently?
Yeah, this mechanism is absolutely fundamental to how fast and reliably our brains can process information. For decades, there were basically two main competing theories about how vesicles get recycled after they release their neurotransmitter chemicals.
What were they?
First was the full collapse endocytosis model. In this view, the vesicle completely merges its membrane with the outer membrane of the nerve terminal, dumps its contents, and then that patch of membrane has to be slowly pulled back in and reformed into a new vesicle elsewhere. It's a relatively slow process.
Okay, and the second theory?
Was the kiss-and-run model. This suggested the vesicle only fuses transiently, forming a small pore just long enough to release its cargo, the kiss, and then it quickly detaches or runs away intact, ready for rapid refilling and reuse. Neuroscientists argued for years about which model was dominant or if both happened.
But it turns out the reality is actually a unified three-step process that incorporates elements of both.
That's right. Using really cutting-edge time-resolved cryo-electron tomography, basically taking ultra-fast snapshots of synapses in action at the nanoscale, researchers visualized the whole dynamic process, and they proposed this unified model, kiss-shrink-run.
Kiss-shrink-run. Okay, break down those three stages for us. What's happening?
So first, the vesicle performs the kiss it transiently fuses, or maybe semi-fuses, with the presynaptic membrane, opening that stable fusion pore to release its neurotransmitter cargo. Second, and this was the really novel observation, almost instantly, within milliseconds, the vesicle membrane rapidly shrinks its volume down to a consistent, smaller fraction of its original size. Then third, in the vast majority of cases, something like 80% of the time, it detaches from the membrane largely intact, ready for that hyperfast recycling pathway.
So the shrink step is new, and most vesicles don't fully collapse, they mostly run.
Exactly. This resolves the old debate by showing that kiss and run, or rather kiss shrink run, is the dominant pathway for rapid recycling. It avoids that slow process of full membrane collapse and reformation for most release events, which is absolutely critical for maintaining efficient and reliable communication between neurons, especially when they need to fire rapidly.
And the implications go beyond just efficiency, right? The shrink parts suggest something more?
It does. This finding suggests that synaptic vesicles aren't just passive single-use delivery trucks. The fact that they shrink to a specific consistent volume after release might mean they're acting as active components in synaptic computation. By changing their size predictably, they might even encode a form of short-term memory at the synapse, perhaps acting as physical pool engrams that influence the probability or amount of neurotransmitter released in the very next firing event.
Wow, that's a mind-bending idea. Vesicles as tiny computing elements. Okay, we have covered an absolutely enormous range today, from tracing the evolution of ant nests as disease defense, to engineering molecular cages to pull resources from thin air, stabilizing fleeting quantum particles, and finally uncovering the surprisingly intricate, hyperfast dance of communication within our own brains.
It's quite a journey. And you know, if we try to connect this recurring theme, we've seen the importance of complex, essential architectures, whether it's the ant nest design, the structure of a MOF sponge, or the precise mechanism of synaptic vesicle recycling. If we connect that to the largest systems problem of all, human coordination, it leads to a really fascinating final provocative thought. It relates to this concept of common knowledge.
Right, this goes back to ideas studied by cognitive scientists, philosophers, game theorists, this idea of common knowledge needed for coordination.
Yes, the philosopher Steven Pinker discusses this. For even simple coordination, like you and I agreeing to meet for coffee, it's argued we need more than just knowing the plan. I need to know that you know we're meeting, and you need to know that I know that you know, and I need to know that you know that I know, and so on. For perfect coordination, theoretically, this chain of knowing that the other knows needs to be infinite. That's common knowledge.
An infinite regress of knowledge. The challenge being, can our finite brains, our finite skulls, as Pinker puts it, actually represent or compute infinite layers of knowledge?
Exactly. It seems unlikely, right? Even if something is universally obvious, say we both look outside and see it's clearly above freezing, philosophical arguments suggest we might still lack true, perfectly iterated common knowledge because maybe my thermometer reading is slightly different from yours, or my memory is fuzzier. There's always some uncertainty. And yet,
And yet we still manage to meet for coffee. Coordination happens all the time, seemingly seamlessly.
it does. Which suggests that maybe our real-world coordination isn't based on achieving perfect, infinite common knowledge after all. Maybe it's based on something more practical, relying on finite levels of shared knowledge, observing patterns of behavior, making educated guesses based on experience. We use a finite cognitive map to navigate an infinitely complex social world.
Okay, so what does this fundamental philosophical challenge about the limits of human common knowledge mean when we think about the monumental global coordination problems we discussed today? Things like achieving net zero aviation or managing the response to Arctic thawing challenges that require investors, scientists, governments, whole societies to coordinate on an absolutely massive scale.
Well, if even simple two-person coordination might rely on heuristics and finite knowledge rather than perfect common understanding, it raises a really profound question about our collective ability as a species to achieve the truly deep, globally cohesive coordination needed for problems like climate change or sustainable development. Could it be that the biggest unknown we face isn't just the scientific or technological complexity, but a fundamental limit in our ability to generate the truly shared knowledge and trust required for smooth, planet-wide human societal function?
A deep and yes, truly challenging thought to end on. Thank you. That was incredibly insightful today.
It was my pleasure.
And thank you, our listener, for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep questioning, and we'll see you next time.